Welcome to Turkey Abroad. My name is Nicholas Morgan, and I'm a freelance journalist with Aval News. And today, my guest is Atilla Yeşilada, a country risk analyst for Turkey at Global Source Partners. Atilla, pleasure to have you. How are you tonight?
It's my pleasure. Well, it's morning here, but doesn't really make a difference since I've been home for 6 months now, and I intend to stay at least until 2025. Otherwise, I'm fine.
You and me both. Hopefully, we're both fine by 2020. By 2020.
Yeah. So, well, you know, go ahead.
So, I'd like to start with COVID-19 and the impact it's been having on Turkey's economy. So, we're in the middle of what would ordinarily be the tourism season, and needless to say, it has been dramatically affected by the virus. On top of it, the government's statistics agency released new numbers for the second quarter, which showed unemployment at 13% and GDP had shrunk by 10% since last year this time. On top of that, the lira is still struggling to maintain its value against the U.S. dollar. Aside from tourism, several of these problems and a few other ones actually have existed before the pandemic. So my first question to you would be, well, my first request for you would be if you could explain to us how COVID-19 has exacerbated some of these problems, and also if you can rate Turkey's handling of the pandemic.
Well, even before the pandemic, we suffered from serious economic mismanagement in the sense that the Erdogan administration puts ideology before solid economic ideas. His resistance to interest rate hikes when they are necessary, simply because he believes higher interest rates beget higher inflation. More importantly, Mr. Erdogan's efforts to undermine Turkish economic and other fundamental institutions, such as the judiciary, balance of powers, and to use the military and police for his personal aims, as well as cronyism, were deep-seated problems, and as a result of which, IMF's latest estimate shows that Turkey's long-term potential growth rate has declined from slightly under less than 5% to now 3%. This is a massive loss. And unemployment, too, started to creep up before the COVID-19 pandemic, simply because as the industry changed to remain competitive in Europe and other overseas markets, the skill set of the young entrants failed to catch up with that increase. Turkey's, well, overall education years are 9. So, you know, how are you going to cope with artificial intelligence, industry 4.0, et cetera, et cetera? So in addition to cyclical unemployment, which is driven by the business cycle, we started to see signs of a structural unemployment, you know, just a very thorny problem, which means that requirements of the workforce are leaving these people behind. Now, COVID obviously has exaggerated all of these problems in the sense that now, according to the broad definition of unemployment, which includes those who are discouraged from seeking work or whose companies have temporarily laid them off, a fourth of the Turkish labor force is unemployed, is currently not doing anything productive for the economy. And that's a major problem because, not that I'm a medical expert, but I try to read up on this stuff. An effective vaccine will not be distributed globally in less than a year, which means these people will remain unemployed for another year. And as you know, data all over the world shows, the longer a person remains unemployed, the lower the chances of his or her being re-employed. In addition to that, of course, even though President Erdogan decided to normalize the economy, I think as of July, all the restrictions had been lifted. People remained fearful of infection. So Turkey's mainstay, the small services industry, has suffered deeply, and tourism has added to that problem. And finally, for some reason, Mr. Berat Albayrak doesn't like financial capital. He thinks fund managers who invest in Turkey are part of a global ploy to undermine Turkish economy and Mr. Erdogan's administration, as a result of which severe restrictions have been imposed on foreign financial investors' ability to conduct business in Turkey, such as the London swap market being shuttered, short sales in Istanbul Stock Exchange being forbidden, etc. As a result of which, Turkey lost $14.5 billion of financial investment over the last year, which, along with the rising current account deficit, has exacerbated the weakness of the currency, which is one of the worst for performance against the dollar in the emerging markets universe. Go ahead.
So I think it's natural at this point then to bring it over to the finance minister, Berat Albayrak. And I want to specifically go over to an interview he gave with Bloomberg News not too long ago, where he tried to put a positive spin on Turkey's handling of COVID-19 by saying that among many of the OECD countries, Turkey has performed among the best after China, South Korea. And he also mentioned a little bit about the balance of payments issue that many other analysts are worried about, which would create another issue down the line for the economy. So I want to ask you, how would you really rate Berat's performance through COVID-19? He's had to make a lot of decisions under a lot of different conditions, but what has he done right and what has he done wrong to this point?
I think the cup is half empty or half full when it comes to Turkey's combat against COVID-19. On one hand, Turkey has proven that it has an extensive and well-equipped medical system, including hospitals, incubators, respirators, etc. I'm sorry, incubation devices, not incubators, respirators, etc. So that we have been able to keep the fatality to very low numbers. We haven't seen scenes which have now become familiar in Latin America, for instance, people dying on the streets or country running out of coffins. Obviously, the health system has performed very well. But unfortunately, here too, has trumped a sense that Mr. Erdogan realized, as many other leaders across the world, that to stamp down the virus completely, you need to lock down the nation for a very long period of time, probably at least 6 weeks. But the economic cost of that, both for small companies and self-employed people, as well as for the budget, is simply unbearable. So he has loosened the restrictions too early to the risk spread of the virus by underreporting COVID cases. I'm not saying our health minister, Mr. Fahrettin Koca, is lying, but asymptomatic cases which don't require hospitalization are not reported in the daily tally. According to at least two members of the National Science Advisory Board, which advise on COVID matters, the total cases, including asymptomatic ones, are 10 times new cases. I do admit that Mr. Fahrettin Koca has done the right thing by committing these people to home quarantine, and medical teams are checking up on these people. But he also reported that 140,000 asymptomatic patients have been caught breaking the curfew or lockdown. And, Turks are, as all Middle Eastern societies, we like to hug and kiss, and our personal space bubble is much smaller than Americans. So touching is a norm. I mean, if people rub shoulders, it's no big deal. As a result of which, virus, which was first localized in Istanbul and a couple of big cities, has a chance to spread across the country. Now, the mostly Kurdish southeast and south, as well as cities like Ankara and the coastal cities and Sivas, and even the tiny little province at the Georgia border, Bartin, are reporting extremely high caseloads. And I think Mr. Erdogan finally realized the truth that ignoring the outbreak is going to cost him a lot in terms of votes. So restrictions are being reimposed, such as flexible working hours, a complete ban on weddings, circumcisions, ceremonies, which is a Turkish thing, and engagements, etc., etc. These will have some positive impact, but again, I am basically parroting what medical experts have stated in the press. It's too late. The virus load in the country is just too high. And we will need a lockdown, a complete lockdown. Otherwise, coupled with the flu season, the situation is getting much worse. Now, on that, I need to blame Fahrettin Koca again for giving incorrect advice to the government. He stated 2 days ago that a vaccine will arrive and will be distributed by the end of the year.
Maybe and that vaccine is the one coming from Russia.
Yeah, definitely. Turkey is participating in those trials. And I suppose we are also on China's list of friendly nations, which will have some doses of the vaccine. But as far as I understand, these vaccines have not concluded the kind of proper human testing that would be required in a developed economy. And there are certain risks associated with it. But if this is the advice Erdogan and Albayrak is getting, obviously they are going to impose few restrictions and take their time. I mean, why waste a lot of economic output if the vaccine is going to end this menace by the end of the year? The second thing that it's not related to COVID, but it explains why Turkey is in a futile battle with the world to defend an exchange rate, which is indefensible. It is this massive natural gas find off Turkish coast in Black Sea. The reports of a discovery of a huge dome with 320 billion cubic meters of potential gas reserves is certainly correct. And Mr. Erdogan, I think, believes, and Mr. Albayrak, that these are proven reserves which can be easily extracted. And as a result of that, we can leverage our new natural wealth by negotiating deep discounts on long-term natural gas contracts. So even though the gas won't arrive before 2023, according to the official plan, immediately in 2021, our current account deficit will shrink substantially because several long-term contracts are expiring. As well, the industry will get cheaper gas and home heating and electricity bills will decline. So there will be an overall sense of well-being and prosperity. So again, why not defend the currency if you know at some point, events are going to come to your rescue? I think both of these, both a vaccine and immediate exploration of the natural gas reserve, are very slender reeds on which to base policy. And assuming both will go wrong, at least as far as timing goes, as Moody said, Turkey is heading towards a balance of payments crisis. It is impossible to time such things. But if you ask my personal view, a lot depends on the Trump-Biden election. If Biden is elected, he's certainly not anti-Turkey. And he, I think, appreciates the value of Turkey as a strategic player in this region. But he's not going to stand in the way of the Congress, which wants to slap Katsa sanctions on Turkey, or in the case of the judiciary, where Halkbank is being tried for violating Iran sanctions. And both of these cases could be extremely costly both in terms of the physical economic damage as well as investor and saver confidence, and they could precipitate a balance of payment crises event.
You actually touched on a number of topics that I'd really like to dig a little more into. And I think the first one would be the health of the Turkish lira, which seems to be one of the main casualties of COVID-19 at this point. I'd like to rewind a little bit to the fall of 2018 when Turkey's lira began to lose value as a result of many loans coming due and many companies not being able to repay those loans because they were denominated in foreign currencies. And on top of that, you had a sanctions row going on with the U.S. when President Trump slapped sanctions on a number of Turkish officials. And then almost overnight, the lira lost almost or about 30% of its value.
Yeah.
And after that crisis, a lot of questions began to mount about the health of the Turkish banking sector. On one hand, like this month, Fitch Ratings over in London lowered their rating for the bank asset quality, which they said was directly exacerbated by COVID-19. And then you mentioned the reports by Moody's recently, where on September 11th, they downgraded Turkey's sovereign credit rating, which lowers the value of their bonds. And then a few days later, they lowered their marks for not one, but 13 different Turkish banks. So I want to ask you, why is it that the Turkish banking sector is so seemingly chronically unhealthy?
Actually, Turkish banks are extremely well managed. I believe we have, as far as human capacity goes, one of the best banking industries in the emerging markets. The problem is they have been tempted into moral hazard. Not only tempted, but in fact, you know, Shanghai'd into moral hazard. The government wants to overcome the economic slump caused by COVID-19, not by direct budgetary spending, but by giving cheap loans. And, you know, state banks do that freely, of course. They are part of the treasury as far as I'm concerned, but private banks were reluctant. So through several macroprudential means, they have been pushed into making loans. Most of these loans will not come back. I think that's the situation in the United States and EU as well. We know that because banks domiciled in those jurisdictions are putting aside huge loan loss reserves. I don't see why Turkey would be in a better shape. So actually, banking system was not weak, but it has been weakened by improper administrative decisions. In my view, there is no insolvency risk, but there is a huge credit and liquidity risk in the sense that, in my estimate, to a large extent derived from data by Fitch as well as those banks which are quoted on the Borsa Istanbul, bad loans plus extremely risky or distressed loans could be as high as 15% of the total loan portfolio. Now, the number sounds high, but it's not deadly. China is in a worse shape. But it sucks up liquidity in the sense that you're asked to give out new loans. Your deposit base is not growing very rapidly because Turkey is a low savings country. As you said, because ratings are very low, you have difficulty funding yourself abroad. So if outstanding loans don't pay interest or don't pay the principal value at maturity, you're constantly leaking liquidity. And also the capital to equity ratio, which needs to be in line with Basel II and Basel III standards, are overstated. I can't really calculate how overstated they are, but I would be mindful of Turkish banks not actually going insolvent or anything like that, but undershooting Basel two or three capital requirement targets, which means they won't be able to make new loans and they'll have to retain dividends for a very long time, or they will require recapitalization.
So in addition to the lira, the next one I'd like to move on to also is the energy question. And on Monday, Erdogan announced that he was pulling back the seismic survey vessel that he had deployed to the East Mediterranean, and added to that that it opened the door to diplomatic talks with Greece. You already mentioned it also, but back last month, he created a lot of hype about discovering a natural gas deposit in the Black Sea. And if I remember correctly, it did not really do much to boost the value of the lira, minus maybe a momentary blip. But also around that time, shortly afterwards, some of the state-owned news outlets began to air some reports about how Turkey had reduced its energy dependence on Russia and Iran. And it just seemed timed with the Black Sea find. So what I want to ask is, what does all of this geopolitical tension and this emphasis on gas really say about the importance of energy independence to Erdogan and Turkey?
Well, first of all, let me state that I'm not a nationalist or I'm not pro-Erdogan, but I think Turkey's case vis-a-vis Cyprus and the territorial waters in the Ionian Sea are correct. I mean, EU considers entire Cyprus under the sovereignty of Greek Cypriot administration, which is not a fact. And Greece claimed that the tiny islands spread all across Turkey's Aegean and to a certain extent Mediterranean coastline do have their own continental shelves, which means Turkey will have no access to either the fishing or natural resources possibly lying in eastern Mediterranean. I don't think any country would accept these conditions. Now, we may accuse Mr. Erdogan being too brash and too ready to go for his gun rather than trying diplomacy, but essentially, his stance on these issues are widely shared across the political spectrum. In some sense, they are national causes on which Turkey will not back down. Neither will EU sanctions have much impact on Turkey because they are going to be symbolic. This is a typical frozen conflict like Kashmir, Nagorno-Karabakh, and the place between India and China. I don't know how to pronounce
it. The line of contact zone?
Yeah. It will never be solved. And de facto situation, in fact, is de jure. I don't expect any kind of war between either Turkey or Greece or Greek Cypriots. The trouble will start if we discover more natural gas or oil in disputed waters. I'm sure Greek will take us to international courts and will get an injunction on extraction, which means we can only sell that gas or oil at home. And foreign companies will not be willing to invest into these finds. Now, the whole question of the Black Sea find has nothing to do with Turkey's energy independence or energy bill. Turkey was naive enough to sign very long-term contracts with Russia, Iran, Azerbaijan, though Azerbaijan is very flexible, about buying gas at the formula indexed to Brent oil or Ural oil or whatever. And these are national secrets. They are not officially unveiled, but following international data, I think both Iran and Russia are selling us gas at twice the spot market value. But we don't need the Black Sea gas to tell these people to lower their prices or we will not extend the contracts. The fashion right now is liquefied natural gas. There are thousands of tankers patrolling in Mediterranean trying to find somewhere to dump their load. and we're building a string of reconversion or conversion stations. So the argument that, you know, we're going to buy LNG rather than NG is simply sufficient to get discounts. Secondly, Turkey's energy demand is exaggerated because it's based on a master plan of 5% GDP growth and roughly 7% secondary energy demand growth. It's never going to happen. In fact, Turkey's natural gas imports have declined for 2 years, and they are not going to increase. And finally, of course, Turkey is making strides in terms of renewables. I disapprove of hydroelectric plants because they destroy the habitat. There is no doubt about it. But we're also making good progress in thermic, wind, and finally in solar. Eventually, they will not, you know, make up for our natural gas imports, but they will reduce the growth rate of natural gas demand to zero at foreseeable Turkish growth rates. In fact, we don't even need the nuclear power plant that's being built, because there too,
one being built by Russians, just to be clear.
Yeah, exactly. Simply because you know, when it's complete, it's going to sell electricity at, I believe, 13.5 cents per kilowatt, which is much higher than our own costs at this point. And it will condemn us for another 20 years of Russian dominance over our energy needs. So Turkey's entire energy policy needs to be revised. Mr. Erdogan is not being genuine when he says he wants complete energy independence. A leader who wants to do so would immediately reduce dependence on Iranian and Russian energy sources, simply because even though there is no hostility between these three nations, they are historic rivals. I mean, they're competitors for regional influence and economic riches. And I don't want to rely on Russia or Iran for my natural gas supply. So the way to go, if he really wants energy independence, he needs to cut off the umbilical cord to Iran and Russia. There, unfortunately, politics play a predominant role. To buy Russia's favor and to help out Iran, Turkey just has conceded to buying extremely expensive natural gas and oil from these countries.
It does seem a bit self-defeating when you think about it, considering the amount of trouble the energy relationship with Iran through, say, the Halk Bank case has already created and has been prolonged at least for the last 7 or so years that this case has been in the news. And then, of course, all the competition between Turkey and Russia, even if they maintain a level of cordial relations, the tension that's still going on in Idlib over in Syria, and then, of course, in Libya, it just seem a bit illusionary for the goal of energy independence to, you know, still be investing in these ties with two pretty risky countries.
I mean, you're completely right. And what you had just said reinforces my case that we're traditional rivals. It doesn't have to be military rivalry, but we shouldn't be doing each other favors. I mean, look at the relationship between Turkey and Russia. We buy expensive natural gas. We buy very expensive military gadgets like S-400s, which really have no use. We have no need of S-400s or Patriots, because no one has a missile force in the vicinity which will bomb us, except the Russians. I'm sorry. For our Russian friendship, we're willing to annoy NATO and the United States. And what do we get in return? They bombed our soldiers in Idlib. In Libya, they're actively helping General Haftar. They are not really buying anything from us, and visa requirements have not been completely lifted. So this is a completely one-sided relationship. And it is another case of ideology trumping economic or geopolitical reality. The same thing goes for Iran. Iran's explicitly stated goal is to build a Shia wall that stretches from the Afghani border all the way to Lebanon. Clearly, this is not an anti-Turkey project, but it cuts Turkey, which is a predominantly Sunni Muslim country, from its Arab and North African hinterland, which means we won't be able to trade or exert political influence on those countries with that Shia barrier between us. And anything that passes through Syria and Iraq will be taxed and will be would be given to the favor of Iranians. If they want to stop our exports or any other commercial links, they are free to do so. So that too is an extremely one-sided relationship. Turkey, this is one of Turkey's main problems. One, as I said, is institutional collapse. The second is our international ties not making sense in terms of realpolitik, but being driven by this anti-Western and anti-Jewish ideology, and it doesn't serve Turkey any good.
You know, naturally, we have to move over to a topic that, of course, attracts a lot of attention. That is the U.S. presidential elections. And one of the points that you just made about the incoherence, essentially, of Turkish foreign policy and how its current choice of friends does not make sense. That's sometimes an argument used by the Washington community about the current relationship between the U.S. and Turkey, where they think that the alliance has essentially been proceeding on borrowed time. And then, of course, this has been exacerbated by President Trump and his relationship with Erdogan, which has earned him his fair share of criticism, whether it was over refusing to sanction Erdogan's Turkey over the S-400, Trump trying to interfere in the Halk Bank case, or at least being requested to interfere in it. And then, of course, you have the invasion of Syria last year in October. But then you move along to Joe Biden, who during the Obama years, he had met with Erdogan on a number of occasions, including right after the failed coup attempt in July 2016. But then he made that statement to the New York Times about how he would want to work with the Turkish opposition against Erdogan, which didn't exactly earn him many accolades over in Turkey. So given the state of the race right now and the possibility that Trump could lose and Biden may end up in the White House, how do you think Turkey will handle a Biden administration? Do you think that they're apprehensive about losing an ally in President Trump?
Yes, even though bravado is concealing that fear, a Biden administration is going to be a very difficult choice for Turkey. Let me first make a few points. Turkey has some legitimate grievances against the United States, and the leading cause is Fethullah Gulen, which, to the extent I can research, has inspired and orchestrated the 2016 coup. Even now, through his minions, he's trying to undermine social cohesion. And Turkey's legitimately elected government, which is Mr. President Erdogan. But no one in the West buys this story. The West believes Erdogan orchestrated that coup, for which there is no evidence. I mean, he benefited from the results of it, but there is really no evidence that he played any role in its planning or he saw it coming. Keeping Fethullah, obviously he can't be extradited, but at least a congressional committee or a judicial committee, Blue Ribbon Commission, can be established to look into Turkish charges of whether this man is really a conspirator in the Turkish coup. That would go a long way towards improving the relationship. Two, I can also see the American viewpoint, but when America cooperates with Syrian Kurds, for which it has legitimate reasons, it doesn't quite understand how the Turkish general population, quite wrongly, I would admit, associates any Kurdish militia or democratic movement with PKK. And that issue of American Kurdish alliance ought to have been handled more delicately with more guarantees given to Turkey. So these are legitimate grievances. On the other hand, you know, Russia does a lot to annoy Turkey and we don't respond to it. And if we have the same kind of relationship with the United States, an arm's length relationship, transactional, things would get much better. I'm sorry to give such a long introduction, but let me tell you what I think Biden would do. I think Biden would give Turkey a choice. Are you with NATO and the United States in the coming, you know, multipolar world? Or are you going to flirt with Russia and try to remain a NATO member? This is not going to work. So the first Biden effort will be to re-enlist the cooperation of Turkey. And if, for ideological reasons again, Turkey doesn't wish to honor that request, well, if the carrot doesn't work, then the stick will come down. And it doesn't really take a big stick. In fact, just a little flick across the list, the wrist will suffice. Just, you know, an article in Washington Times or New York Times that, you know, Biden is thinking of allowing Kaatsa sanctions is going to cause a rerun of Pastor Brunson event, to which you alluded, in 2018. And no one in the United States is going to buy Turkish bonds or give Turkey new loans. Game over. So America has very effective means of persuading Turkey to do its bidding. I am not saying this is ethically correct. I'm trying to talk real politics here. But Mr. Erdogan will have probably, I think Biden takes over in January, officially speaking, right? The new president, yeah. So he will have 6 months or so until Biden sorts out the mess left behind Trump and moves on to the Middle East. But he shall do something about Turkey. As I've said, Turkey has several correct points in East Med, Cyprus, vis-a-vis Fethullah Gulen, et cetera, but there has to be a new modus operandi to define Turkey's role in the Western alliance. You can't be one leg out, one foot in.
Atilla Yeşilada, I really enjoyed the conversation that we had tonight, and I really hope to have you again in the future.
It will be my pleasure. This was very entertaining and educational for me as well. I wish you an entire Ahval News, who are my friends, much luck and much traffic. Have a good day.
Thank you very much, Atilla. My name is Nicholas Morgan, and this is Turkey Abroad.
You can follow Ahval News online podcast series through Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, Google Podcasts, SoundCloud, and Spreaker. All you need to know about Turkey is here, for your ears, mind, and attention. Thank you for listening to our podcast.